2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 224. Behold, I will unfold this mystery unto you. Mormon Readings of the Zohar. A paper presented by Bruce Kenneth Smith with a response by Bruce B. Brogman.
I'm Glenn Cornett. I'm in the Palo Alto Second Ward in the Menlo Park Stake in California. I run a small business that does amusing things with biotechnology companies and other science and technology intensive organizations. I'm happy to be here to chair a session on Kabbalah and some Mormon readings thereof. I have held a tremendous fascination with the subject for years, so I'm very gratified to be here. Let me introduce our two people, both named Bruce. The first one presenting is Bruce Kenneth Smith, undergraduate from University of Utah in Middle Eastern Studies, now a PhD candidate in Jewish Studies at New York University. He focuses on Jewish mysticism, and he specializes in Zohar, and is spent a lot of time around Mormons, given his ordeal at U of U and such, so he can probably take whatever you toss at him. Bruce Rogman has an MBA from BYU and is president of the Servant Leadership Center. He does workshops on the Tree of Life with a Kabbalist understanding of the Tree of Life. So this should be interesting to see what he has in response. Without further ado, Bruce.
Yeah, which one now?
Part of the mystery.
That's part of the mystery of Kabbalah. There you go. Okay, so since about the late 1980s, early 1990s, our attention has been drawn by a number of Mormon authors and writers to Mormon history and theology and Jewish mystical tradition, which we call Kabbalah. For example, D. Michael Quinn, in Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, suggested that 1 Nephi 1-2 could have associated the Book of Mormon with the mystery and magic of the Jewish Kabbalah based on a 17th century Hermetic usage of the phrase learning of the Jews, which at that time referred to Kabbalah itself. Then in 1994, Lance Owens wrote his article on Joseph Smith and Kabbalah. And given the types of Jewish literature that Alexander Niebauer cited in the Times and Seasons, he suggested the following. If Niebauer had read to Joseph from any single text or explained Kabbalistic concepts contained in a principal book, the Zohar would have been the book with which to start. This might explain why in 1844, Smith, in what may be his single greatest discourse, and in the most important public statement of his theosophical vision, apparently quotes almost word for word from the first section of the Zohar. Then in 1998, in the revised and enlarged edition of Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, Quinn added an entire section on what he called Kabbalistic occultism in Mormonism, making reference both to non-Jewish English works on Kabbalah and to the aforementioned citations of the Zohar. However, these are not the only instances that we find of Mormon usages of the Zohar and discussions on Kabbalah. On just a popular level, for example, Alexander Joseph, a Mormon fundamentalist in southern Utah, used gematria in his analysis of the Joseph Smith papyri and the LDS temple endowment. In a Mormon apologetic work entitled The 1,000 Evidences for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the authors cite the Zohar in their discussion on eternal marriage, saying, from the Jewish Zohar, which dates back to the early Christian era, we learn that the Jews also accepted this doctrine, referring to the LDS doctrine of eternal marriage. And even on the web, on a website called GayMormon.com, there's an analysis of the sun, moon, and earth stones on the Salt Lake Temple using what they call the Kabbalic Tree of Life, i.e. the spherotic chart, where they map the spherot onto the various stones in the original design for the Salt Lake Temple. So it's out there. And as we can see, there are a variety of concerns and interests that come into play in this discussion of Mormonism and Kabbalah. However, I'd like to do something a little different. What I want to do is, instead of attempting to either trace the contributing factors or causal connections as a historian might, or compare Mormon theology with Kabbalistic notions, I will be attempting to understand the various Mormon usages of Zohar in terms of Mormonism itself. This means I'm going to be asking a slightly different type of question. I'll be asking questions like, what is the stated purpose, if any, of the Zoharic citation? What is the topic being discussed? Are they citing from a variety of Jewish sources? And if they do, are they differentiating between the various types or genres of Jewish literature, or do they see it all as one uniform body? In essence, I'm suggesting that without a contextualized understanding of Mormon usages of the Zoharic literature within a Mormon worldview, we're going to be unable to do either of the above. However, before that, I got to define a couple terms and set some boundaries. In general, I want to acknowledge that the stuff that makes up human experience is never as neat and as tidy as might appear in a paper like this. More specifically, we have to recognize that the boundaries that we draw for such a study inevitably include or exclude an instance that another researcher might have done otherwise. However, without such boundaries, to quote a famous saying, we would ever be learning and never coming to a knowledge of the truth. So in this particular study, I've looked at examples of Zoharic citations in Mormon usage, where what constitutes Mormon usage would include instances that range from official LDS publications to Mormon-oriented publications for just like a general audience, to just individual writings that have been posted on the internet or distributed privately. Unfortunately, this is not an exhaustive catalog of such usages, both due to the number of privately distributed writings that take place in Mormon culture, the explosion on the internet, and also time. I will go over time probably as it is, and Bruce has to eat some of this. Rather, what I will do is present a survey of some of the most prominent examples of Mormon usages of the Zohar, such as Alexander Niebauer, B.H. Roberts, Bruce R. McConkie, and Hugh Nibley. Also, I need to clarify two terms, Kabbalah and Zohar. First, regarding Kabbalah, there are a number of different definitions, either historical or phenomenological. And for our purposes, for mine, what I need, I'm going to be using a phenomenological definition of this Jewish mystical tradition. In this sense, it refers to a tradition that has three aspects or elements that serve as its defining characteristics: the theosophical, the theurgic, and the ecstatic. The theosophical refers to the various hypostatic potencies or powers within the divine that are alternately called midot, attributes of God, or sephirot. And depending upon the historical period, these numbers for these potencies range from one to an infinity. The second element is the theurgic. This is conceptualized as the impact man's actions have via the 613 commandments in Jewish law upon the divine world. And the last aspect that defines Kabbalah is the ecstatic. This refers to the mystical experience, which can range from just adhesion of the mystic to God, where there's still some division between the individual and God, to a total unity of the mystic and God. These three elements all contribute to Kabbalah's central focus, which is knowledge of the divine name, which in Kabbalah is tantamount to knowledge of God, given its essentialist understanding of the relationship between the thing that is named and the name itself. They are seen as one. And second, the Zohar. The Zohar presents itself as a Tanaitic, i.e. a 2nd century CE, commentary on the Torah. However, the reality is quite different. Actually, it's even inappropriate to refer to the Zohar as a book, given our common understanding of a book that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Rather, it's best to refer to it more like the Zoharic literature, since it's a weaving together of various textual elements or layers. But for our purposes, I'm still going to refer to it as the Zohar. These textual elements came about via an ecstatic or a revelatory experience of a circle of Jewish mystics in the late 13th century in northern Spain. In other words, their mystical experience of the divine, or God, was constituted as a hermeneutical experience of the Torah. In other words, the practice of interpretation was their mystical experience. As a result of understanding the Torah as being woven together with the various names of God, or that the Torah was itself the name of God, these mystics saw the Torah not so much as a historical document or as a piece of wisdom literature, but as being contextualized within the divine itself, that the Torah was the body of God. That was God's body, these words. Thus, for example, when they read of Abraham's travels to Egypt, they do not see this as something essentially historical. Rather, they see this as referring to the inner workings or dynamics of the divine itself. So let's now look at a number of Mormon instances of Zoharic usage, starting with Alexander Niebauer. He was the first Mormon author to cite the Zohar, He was a German convert to Judaism, to Mormonism in England, and he wrote an article on the resurrection and the times and seasons. Let's first look at the stated purpose of the article to contextualize his citations. The editor for the newspaper introduced his article saying, "The following very singular notions of the Jews with regard to their resurrection will no doubt be read with interest by many of the curious, especially the lovers of Jewish literature. We do not give publicity to it to establish the idea that the Jews believe in the resurrection. This every intelligent man must concede." So in other words, the purpose is not to demonstrate that the Jews believe in resurrection. So what is it then? The first glimpse we get about the purpose is in the phrase "very singular notions." The term "singular," according to the Oxford Dictionary, refers to that which is different from or not complying with that which is customary, usual or general, strange, odd or peculiar. Thus, the following article is a presentation of those ideas that are strange, odd or peculiar. However, Niebauer's preface to his article is much clearer. He states, "The gospel says blindness in part has happened unto Israel." The reader of this will perceive how far the apostle was correct in his assertion. So in other words, Niebauer is presenting these various Jewish texts in order to demonstrate the blindness that has happened unto Israel. In other words, by citing these texts, which show a diversity of opinion among the Jews, he demonstrates that they are in apostasy, holding false beliefs regarding a basic theological precept. Now when we think back on what the editor had said regarding the very singular notions of the Jews, we can now understand that part of his intention was to show those somewhat odd or contrary beliefs that exist among the Jews regarding resurrection. Now let's look at one of the citations of the Zohar that Niebauer gives, and I want to look at one particular statement. The reference I have chosen is the one that a number of Mormon authors have used to suggest an explicit link between Kabbalistic thinking and Mormon teachings. Niebauer says the following: "The Zohar speaks differently on the subject, i.e. resurrection. Those who died in the Promised Land will rise 40 years before those who died without its boundary. Now everyone that dies without and has but one relative there to mourn for him can rest most assuredly to profit by the resurrection, because his relative in the Promised Land has power to raise all his kinsmen who died out of it. But this quickening is connected with a painful sensation called by them Gilgul Mecholos, the rolling in the caves." And I'm going to focus on that one phrase. Owens, when writing about this, says, "His essay deals ostensibly with the conception of resurrection held by the Jews. What he discusses for the most part is, however, the Kabbalist concept of Gilgul, the transmigration and rebirth of souls." Quinn, in his book, characterized this passage, saying, "In June, Niebauer's article was about the very singular notions of the Jews with regard to their resurrection, which was the term Niebauer used repeatedly and quoted his Kabbalistic sources as using. However, in one instance, the first of Niebauer's two articles, this concept was called by them Gilgul. This was an English phonetic spelling of Gilgul, transmigration of souls, or metempsychosis. It is true that the Hebrew word Gilgul can be a technical term for resurrection. However, like all words, its meaning is determined by context. First, the word itself is based on a root meaning to roll or fold or unfold, like one does with a scroll, for example. Second, we need to notice it is associated with another Hebrew word, mechilot. That's the way I pronounce it. In fact, if we pay close attention to what Niebauer wrote, he's already given a translation of the phrase Gilgul mechilot. It means the rolling in the caves. Not surprisingly, mechilot means caves. The passage that describes this is in Zohar 1:128b, where it says the following. Rabbi Yochanan said, "Who directs the body to the land of Israel?" I.e., if I died and was buried here in the United States, the only place that I get resurrected is in the land of Israel. How does my body get there? Rabbi Zera answered, "The Holy One, blessed be He, makes tunnels, mechilot, under the land, and the bodies roll, mitgalgel, to the land of Israel." In other words, if I died here in Salt Lake and I was buried in Salt Lake in a Jewish cemetery, at the time of resurrection, my body rolls to the land of Israel in these tunnels to get resurrected. This usage of the phrase Gilgul Mechilot to refer to the bodies rolling in the tunnels underneath the ground to get to the land of Israel is a common idea in early Jewish literature. For example, in the Talmud it says, "And of the righteous ones who are outside of the land of Israel, are they not alive?" And Rabbi Elah replied, "Yes, by means of Gilgul." And Rabbi Abba said, tunnels, mechilot, were made for them in the ground. Thus we can see that Niebuhr is not speaking about reincarnation. Rather, he's discussing exactly what he said he was, the rolling of the corpses in caves towards the land of Israel in order to be resurrected. Moreover, it needs to be emphasized again that his intent in bringing these various citations, including the Zohar, is to demonstrate the partial blindness of the Jews. Let's go to the second example, B.H. Roberts. He uses the Zohar at a time, he wrote about it at a time when he was the mission president in New York. In the late 1920s, the editor of a Christian Messianic newspaper, the Redeemed Hebrew, Christian Messianic would refer to Jews who have converted to Christianity, discussed a book which described the conversion of an Orthodox Jew to Christianity and the reasons for his conversion. A Canadian rabbi who had read this particular book wrote to the Redeemed Hebrew, attempting to refute the textual interpretations found therein. It was in this setting that Roberts contributed a series of letters to this newspaper responding to the rabbi. These letters were later reprinted by the Deseret News Press as Rasha the Jew, A Message to All Jews, in 1932. In addition to these letters, this book also contained a number of articles that Roberts had written attempting to demonstrate the validity of the LDS Church. In his initial response to the rabbi's letter, Roberts says, "Some of the major prophecies of the Bible ought to be considered in connection with our discussion of the identity of Jehovah in the Old Testament with the Christ in the New. Although the rabbi, Rasha, does not include consideration of them in his paper, but the opportunity to present some thoughts upon these prophecies is too fine to be admitted." So he's telling us he's going to look at messianic prophecies in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. It was in this way that he introduced his section on these prophecies, showing that what Christians have believed are messianic prophecies in the Old Testament were also considered that by Jewish sources. And this section includes citations from Targumim, which are Jewish translations of the Bible into Aramaic, the Maharal of Prague, a famous 18th century rabbi, and the Zohar. The one messianic prophecy where Roberts quotes the Zohar is in Numbers 24:17. And the King James for this reads, "I shall see him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Seth." Roberts then notes the following. It is claimed by some Jewish interpreters that David fulfilled, at least in part, this prophecy, since he did smite Moab and Edom. From early times, however, Jewish commentators have held the passage to be messianic. The star that should rise out of Egypt being held to have reference to David's greater son, the Messiah, rather than to David. So held Rabbi Zohar Kadosh, 14th century, commenting on Numbers 24:17. This star to rise in Israel is the Messiah. Now, the actual citation, the referencing that he uses, is a bit unclear since it's not to a standard edition of the Zohar that we use today. So it's difficult to find what he's referring to. But the best possibility is Zohar 2, 172b, where it talks about seven periods of times, which it calls windows. Kind of like using the word window in the sense of like a launch window. It's a period of time. And the seventh window is described as a messianic time period. And this is what it says. "And when the seventh window is opened on all the world, its star is the star from Yaakov," Jacob, "which is what Balaam, said, the star's path from Yaakov. This star will shine for 40 days and 40 nights. And when the King Messiah is revealed, all of the peoples of the world will enter in before the King Messiah in order that what is said will be fulfilled, that the root of Jesse, which will stand as a sign to the peoples, to him the nations will seek, and his rest will be glorious." What's unusual about this citation is the nomenclature he uses for the Zohar itself, Rabbi Zohar Kadosh. First, let's deal with spelling. He spells Zohar instead of Z-O-H-A-R, S-O-H-A-R. This suggests that the source that he's citing from is originally a German source, since that's how they write Zohar in German. Second, the phrase Zohar Kadosh, written this way, the Kadosh is spelled C-A-D-A-S-H, somewhat unusual, can be found in a number of Protestant English biblical commentaries like Adam Clark's, to which Roberts would have had access. If you look at his works, The Truth, the Way, and the Life, you'll see a lot of these Protestant thing commentaries that he uses also cite Zohar. Moreover, the usage of the Zohar was rather common among early Protestant writers who were attempting to demonstrate that Christian doctrines could be found in non-biblical Jewish texts. One example of this is an early Baptist minister in England named John Gill. He has probably, in his commentary last time I checked, there are probably 50 to 75 references to Zohar itself. Thus, it's possible that his source for his citation was from one of these commentaries. Another possibility, though, is one of the Messianic newspapers. He obviously was writing to a Messianic newspaper in Canada, and in his book, The Truth, the Way, and the Life, he uses another Messianic newspaper in his discussion of the word Elohim. So it could also have come from there. But regardless of the source, given that he refers to the Zohar, this book, as Rabbi Zohar Kadosh, this indicates that he probably was not aware of what the Zohar actually was. He may have merely been following one of the many Christian presentations of Jewish literature as evidence for the truth of Christianity. Minimally, we can say, though, that he saw that the Zohar, using the Zohar, was a way or an effort to validate a particular Christian claim, i.e., the messianic nature of a biblical passage. Let's go to the next one, Bruce R. McConkie. He used his in his multi-volume work on the Messiah, the Messiah trilogy. And he quotes the Zohar in a chapter titled, The Discourse Upon Cleanliness. In order to help us get a sense of the tone of his discussion, I'd like to quote two of the scriptural references that he has prior to his chapter. The first one is Jacob 4:14, which says, The Jews were a stiff-necked people. Because of their blindness, which blindness came by looking beyond the mark, they must needs fall. The second quote is from 2 Nephi 10:5, and it says, Because of priestcrafts and iniquities, they at Jerusalem will stiffen their necks against him, that he be crucified. So in other words, the point he's making is, due to Jewish legalism, i.e. looking beyond the mark, the Jews were blinded, and as a result of their blindness, they became intransigent, can't talk, and they rejected Jesus' truth claims. Describing this particular period in Jesus' life, McConkie says, Now the spirit of darkness and death is beginning to brood over whole cities and areas. Whole multitudes are infected with the virus of apostasy and persecution and destruction. It is an hour when we shall see tribes and congregations, blinded by priestcrafts and looking beyond the mark, join with their rulers to oppose the cause of truth and righteousness, i.e., to oppose Jesus' claims. Regarding the ceremonial washing specifically, he states, with some inward revulsion, we turn our attention to the ceremonial washings of rabbinism, to the daily, almost hourly, ritualistic ablutions which alone, as they supposed, kept uncleanliness from their doors. The Zohar passage that he cites is actually within a larger quote from a work by Cunningham Geikie, entitled The Life and the Words of Jesus, of Christ, which was written in the late 1800s. There he says, the legal washing of the hands before eating was especially sacred to the rabbinist. Not to do so was a crime as great as to eat the flesh of swine. He who neglects the hand washing, says the book Zohar, spelled with an S, deserves to be punished here and hereafter. He is to be destroyed out of the world, for in hand washing is contained the secret of the Ten Commandments. This quote is from a particular passage in Zohar in a section called Raya Mehemna, in a particular in Parshat Pinchas. We Jews divide the Torah in various parshiot, in sections that we read every Shabbat. The passage says the following. Second is the washing of hands using the amount of water that has been determined by the sages. And this is the five fingers of the right hand, in which there are 14 segments. If you count the segments of your fingers between the knuckles, there are actually 14 segments, right? And on the left hand, there are 14 segments on the left hand. Combined, there are 28 segments in which to reveal the power of the name of God. As a note, the word power in Hebrew, koach, equals 28. These are also the 28 letters of the first statement of Maaseh Bereshit, or the works of the chariot. I.e., if you look at the first sentence in the book Genesis, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, and you count the letters, there are 28. Of which it is said of them, and now let the power of the Lord be great. And the 10 fingers are analogous to the 10 statements of the work of creation, because we Jews count that, say that there are nines, vayomers, and God said, and the first one, Bereshit, is the 10th. So we have 10 statements. And it is because of this that what the sages taught is established, saying, one who neglects the washing of hands is uprooted from the world. Why is this? It is because within the 10 fingers is the secret of the 10 statements of the work of creation. And by means of these 28 letters was the world created. Now, McCaukey's citations of non-Jewish biblical literature were always of a general nature, and most times they were within larger quotations from other works. But at least, even with that, it appears that he was using the Zohar as some sort of authentic expression of Judaism, albeit in a negative way. Now let's go to Hugh Nibley for a sec. Nibley is one of the more prolific writers on Mormonism, and he certainly is the one Mormon who has quoted the Zohar more than any other. If one just looks at the collected works of Hugh Nibley, there are over 30 Zoharic citations. And given the number of Zoharic citations within his works, whose topics range everywhere from Enoch to the temple endowment to preexistent, I'm going to choose one that is sort of representative of his approach to the Zohar. In the message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, Nibley cites the Zohar with respect to the gates or levels that temple initiate experiences. In other words, what he's hinting at is the movement from the various rooms in the temple endowment, the creation room, the garden room, the world room, the terrestrial room, the celestial room. That's what he's trying to hint at, talking about it in the context of the Egyptian temple endowment. And he says this, "Steps may take the place of gates, that being the literal designation of a degree of advancement. This common symbolism is brought out in the Zohar, where it says the following, the gate of Psalm 24:2 refers to the supernal grades, literally steps, by and through which alone a knowledge of the Almighty is possible to man, and without which a man could not communicate with God. Those gates are the doors for the soul. And the gate of righteousness at the present time remains unknown because Israel is in exile, and therefore all the other doors are removed from them, so they cannot know or commune." I.e., these gates that it's talking about here in the Zohar are referring to the various progressions that you go through for the temple endowment. So in order for us to reflect a little on what Nibley's usage, I'd like to cite just my own translation of this so you get a different take on it at least. Rabbi Schumann said, "Her husband is known at the gates. And what are the gates? As it says in Psalms, lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, everlasting openings. On account of these gates, which are supernal degrees, on account of them, the Holy One, blessed be He, is known. And if not, then no one is able to cleave to Him. Come and see, the neshama, that's the Hebrew word for soul, and that particular word is used for Jews alone. Jews have neshamot, non-Jews do not. Non-Jews are one step lower in this regard as far as Kabbalah is concerned. The soul can only be known through the organs of the body, which are degrees that do the work of the soul. Thus, the soul is both known and unknown. So also, the Holy One, blessed be He, is both known and unknown, because He is the soul's soul and the spirit's spirit, hidden and concealed from all. So there's a limit to the knowledge that one can apprehend of God through this. But by means of these gates that are the openings of the soul, the Holy One, blessed be He, is known. Now the gates refer to the sefirot. It is by means of the sefirot, these potencies within the divine, that one comes to know God. Regarding how Nibley understood the Zohar, he is the one Mormon writer who actually describes what the Zohar is. For example, in 1967, he describes the Zohar as perhaps the oldest Jewish writing known. In 1975, in an Ensign article on Enoch, he says that the Zohar is a work whose prestige and respectability have greatly increased in recent years. Later in the same article, he quotes a German Jewish scholar, Adolf Jelinek, as saying the following, "Moses of Leon, parentheses 12th century, and the Zohar toward the end of the 13th century all cite from the book of Enoch." Now this comment is interesting due to an unexplained addition in the quote. The original of Jelinek says the following. Now I get to practice my little German and do a little Hebrew. I'm so happy. Mose der Leon sowie der Zohar gegen Ende des 13. Jahrhunderts ein Sefer Hanoch kennen und zitieren. In other words, what I just said is, Moses of der Leon, as well as the Zohar toward the end of the 13th century, are well aware and cite from the Book of Enoch. The phrase 12th century doesn't exist in Jelinek's text. Somehow that was added. It apparently would suggest that Nibley was saying that Moshe de Leon was from the 12th century. Obviously, he knows he's not. It's an interesting addition. And lastly, in a series of honors lectures in 1986, Nibley described the Zohar as follows, a very important writing which has been neglected by the Jews. They come back to it. They used to think it was just an invention of Moses of Leon in 1240 AD, a work of the Middle Ages, but now they know it is very old. Thus, while he mentions the medieval dating of the Zohar, he pushes it to a much earlier period. Yet this is not surprising given his, this is not so surprising because for the Zohar for Nibli is seen as a support for various LDS beliefs and texts. So now let's step back a little. Let's talk about what's been going on here. First, we have a Jewish convert to Mormonism writing to Mormons about the various Jewish conceptions about the resurrection in an effort to show the partial blindness that has befallen Israel. We have a mission president responding to a Jew, attempting to show that Jesus was the Messiah of the Hebrew Bible, and then collecting these letters for the purpose of missionary efforts towards Jews. We have an apostle writing about the life of Jesus, showing in a number of instances the legalism of the Pharisees. And finally, we have a Mormon scholar using the Zohar in his presentation of ancient parallels to LDS theology. So why the Zohar? Minimally, we can say that these authors saw the Zohar as an authentic representation of Jewish thought. That's obvious, or they wouldn't have quoted it. But it's the phrase authentic representation of Jewish thought, if we play around with this a little, that may help us come to understand the Mormon context for their usage of Zohar. The first question to ask is there authentic representations of Jewish thought authentic? Given the nature of Kabbalah, this is questionable. For example, when the Zohar speaks of the washing of hands as symbolic of God's creative power, understanding this as a way to experience the divine, imbuing man with the divine overflow, is this the legalism to which McConkie is referring? Probably not. When the Zohar speaks of the gates, which are the Sfirot, as the path to the divine, with the gate of righteousness, i.e., the lowest of the ten Sfirot, which is a feminine Sfira called Malchut, with all of the erotic connections that one can play with the notion of openings, being the entrance to the rest of the Sfirot, is this the physical progression the temple patron experiences about which Nibli speaks? Probably not. So what is the meaning of authentic in the phrase authentic representations of Jewish thought? The authenticity lies in the fact that those Zoharic quotes are an authentic representation of Jewish thought as Jewish thought is constructed within Mormonism. To put it another way, instead of their interpretation reflecting the meaning of the Zohar is reflecting the Mormon meaning of Jewish texts. One way to speak about this is the following, based on the convergence of two terms in English, Kabbalah and mysteries. For example, regarding secrecy and the endowment, Nibley states the following. In a widely circulated comment on the Joseph Smith papyri, Professor John A. Wilson wrote, "The notion that the ancient Egyptians were Kabbalistic esoterics devoted to hiding their mysteries from others dies hard. If hiding mysteries from others makes one a Kabbalistic esoteric," this is now Nibley's comment on that quote, "then the Egyptians were just that, as were the Jewish sectaries and the early Christians." Earlier, even John Taylor made the following statement and a similar connection. "Among the various nations in different ages, their sages and wise men held their intelligence as a secret mystery to be divulged almost or altogether to their disciples, who generally conveyed it in unknown characters, symbols, or hieroglyphics. The Jews had their wise men, and all the more or less mysterious or Kabbalistic." Even earlier, Noah Webster's dictionary notes, Kabbalah is defined as a tradition or mysterious kind of science among the Jewish rabbis, pretended to have been delivered to the ancient Jews by revelation and transmitted by oral tradition, serving for the interpretation of difficult passages of scripture. In each of these examples, there's a connotation of Kabbalah as that of mysteries. So now we need to ask ourselves, what is the notion of mystery within Mormonism? To answer this, I'm going to give three examples from the Book of Mormon. The first type of mystery that we find is in 1 Nephi 1:1, where Nephi says that he has been highly favored by God in knowing of his goodness and mystery, i.e., mysteries of God. So that's one type. The second type of mystery we find is in Alma 30:31, in an incident regarding Korihor, where the text speaks of pretended mysteries. That's two. And the last type of mystery that the Book of Mormon notes is in Alma 37, where it talks about the 24 plates, where they contained the mysteries and works of darkness and their secret works, or the secret works of those people who have been destroyed. That's our third. So in other words, according to the Book of Mormon, there are three types of mysteries: mysteries of God, pretended mysteries, and mysteries of darkness. Now let's apply this back to what we've been doing. What I'm really suggesting is the following, that the Mormon usage of the Zohar is connected to two issues. One, the Mormon construction of Judaism, both as the original receiver of the divine revelation and as now being apostate. And also, it's connected to the Mormon conceptualization of mysteries, since Kabbalah equals mystery. Thus, the usage of Zohar acts as a mirror reflecting both the authentic Mormon representation of Judaism and specifically the Mormon conception of mystery depending upon the topic at hand. So thus, if it's a doctrine like resurrection, then issues of apostasy and pretended mysteries might influence their reading of Zohar. If it's a doctrine like the temple endowment, then issues of original receiver of divine revelation and mysteries of godliness will come to the fore in their reading of Zohar. At the very least, what we can see is that the Mormon understanding and usage of the Zohar acts as reflections of the particular Mormon conceptualizations. Let me try that sentence one more time. Blew that one entirely. At the very least, seeing Mormon understanding and usage of the Zohar as reflections of these particular Mormon conceptualizations, i.e., mystery and the general conception of Judaism, this helps us better appreciate the significance of Zoharic citations within Mormon literature. Thanks.
J. Bonarucci, one of the great...
I need my glasses here.
That's all you had memorized?
I do not.
J. Bonarucci, one of the great mentors of LDS scholarship, once stated, "A problem among the members of the Mormon Church is all too frequently they possess zeal without knowledge. They have a passion and a zeal to be part of the truth of the restored Latter-day Church, but lack adequate foundation of knowledge. Zealots..." the root word of zeal, "even Mormon ones, who possess a high passion to make a difference in the world, can oversimplify and use zeal as a priority over knowledge to declare truth. They become, in the words of Nibley, mincy instead of becoming as a Christ-like scholar. We learn from Alma 32, the perfect knowledge comes from faith. Many Mormons errantly confuse their faith for zeal. Knowledge is the mature harvest of the seed of faith, examining and discovering what is true by nourishing it within." Reminds me of a quote I heard of last year's Sunstone. I can't remember who gave this quote, but I love the quote. "There are two kinds of Mormons I do not trust, those who never think and those who only think."
Robert Reese,
thank you. In Bruce Smith's paper on Mormon readings from the Zohar, we are reminded of problems that come with a zeal without knowledge, even by some of the best, even Christ-like scholars of the church, Nibar, Roberts, McConkie, and Nibley. Bruce Smith approaches the connections between Zoharic literary sources, including mystical medieval Judaism, from a paradigm of being an insider. His background, mindset, worldview, and paradigm is uncontaminated, at least I thought it was uncontaminated, by Mormon scripting and programming until I find out he went to the University of Utah. His paper hammers home the importance of how our mindset influences how we see and interpret our view, and as a result can lead us from truth and separate us from the world community, albeit unintentionally. Is Smith qualified to tell us the Mormon scholarly community has misinterpreted the Zohar? In the research he documents in this paper, and in my cursory analysis of his sources, interviewing him, reading his papers, in the few hours I've had to do so, I believe the answer is a yes. Smith, when it comes to having the mindset and paradigm of a medieval Kabbalist, I cannot say the word as he does, however, I'm certainly not qualified as a respondent to this paper to question the scholarship of four great power and misinterpreted or mistranslated some of these documents. This occurred because they had used their Mormon scaffolding as a metaphorical Urim and Thummim in which to see. By so doing, they did not use the Urim and Thummim the ancient rabbis had when they wrote the documents. They were blinded to the truth because of the zeal to see what they wanted to see, to enhance the positive image of the institutional church and the particular Mormon doctrine they were trying to persuade the reader to believe in. Smith points out that Nibley's understanding of the Zohar improved and was enhanced from 1967 through his later works, and persuaded this view changed the same way any view or opinion is changed through knowledge of the authentic. On page 20, we learn from Smith the core problem in his findings and his research. Quote, "Zohar quotes are in authentic representation of Jewish thought, as Jewish thought is constructed within Mormonism. Instead of their interpretation reflecting the meaning of the Zohar is reflecting the Mormon meaning of the Jewish texts. The religious fervor and zeal of members of the Mormon Church to maintain the trueness of an institutional church, and more than any other, carries with it the temptation to interpret everything that supports this positive image of the church. We use this as a guide for decisions to determine if actions and behaviors are good or evil. If it is good, it helps the image of the church. If it is harming the image of the church, it is not. It is evil. This runs contrary to the standard Moroni in Moroni 7 teaches, where good and evil are measured by a higher standard of persuading a deeper commitment to the divine. The follies of our four scholars, Smith cites, was not intentional deception to misinform. Rather, it was errant scholarship. All four LDS scholars, he cites, possess far more scholarly abilities than I ever hope to attain, so why am I writing a paper emphasizing their scholarly deficiencies? Quite simply, it's to point out to the Mormon scholars, Mormon members of the church, and even to the Hyde Park corner of the church, that zeal without knowledge is a serious flaw of scholarship. There are many in this room who have quoted the four scholars Smith cites many times. Somehow in a priesthood meeting or a gospel doctrine class, it's nice to throw out great quotes from our scholarly heroes. When we quote them, people think we're smart. So the responsibility for scholarly research, especially among our own Sunstone community, must be to the highest of all standards, zeal with knowledge. The coming forth of the Book of Mormon and early sections of the Doctrine and Covenants of the Restored Gospel itself emphasize the most economical interpretation is to use mystical means of reading through special mystical seer stones, the Urim and Thummim, to discover truth and the original intent of the author. It ignores collecting data from many other original sources and into seeing patterns and conclusions that they reveal. Among the four primary authors Smith cites, they zealously use their own modern-day Urim and Thummim to interpret the Zohar. In this zeal, they omitted intended meaning by the Kabbalists who authored them. The translators needed a medieval Hebrew version of the Urim and Thummim for a translation, which Smith has, not a 19th century Mormon Urim and Thummim. How we see things determines where and how we will look for the data. In the area of analyzing and quoting the Zohar, we are reminded how important this long, gradual process of obtaining knowledge is, and it must not be contaminated by excessive zeal. The Zoharic texts are the fourth and ultimate tier of Judaic scholarship, the first step being the understanding that comes from the Torah, available to young Jewish boys in their early teens. The second step would be gaining an understanding of the Talmud, generally reserved for a male in his 20s. In the movie Yento, we see a third step depicted, an analysis in the Midrash writings. All the writings build upon each other, as the Midrash is a further interpretation of the Talmud and the Torah. Midrash scholarship was reserved generally for the 30s. The writings of the Zohar and its many accompanying texts and interpretations were historically reserved for Jewish males in their 40s. It was thought that men not fully initiated in the first three steps would not have the spiritual maturity to understand, and therefore the Zohar could do more harm than good. Consequently, in the community of Jewish scholars, those who interpreted the Zohar had decades of knowledge, not merely zeal, to provide the foundation to guide correct interpretation. Unless Mormons, even the best of Mormon scholars, go through the same process, they are likely to misinterpret the Zohar in the original Jewish context. The goal of all four of these steps, understanding the Torah, the Talmud, the Midrash, and the Kabbalistic writings, including the Zohar, is not an intellectual pursuit. These four standard works are tools to activate the 10 divine sparks of Godhood within each one of us. Kabbalists are drawn together by the desire to discover hidden mysteries of God contained in all four levels of their scriptures. Through meditating upon the Holy Word of God, acts of service, prayer, kavana, and applying various Hebrew literary tools of interpretation, such as gematria that Smith referred to, a practicing Kabbalist can learn the path to become more like God. The Hebrew word Kabbalah really translated means to receive. One can receive light and truth from God, good health, happiness, financial security, reduced stress, healthy relationships, peace of mind, spiritual enlightenment through practicing Kabbalah. A person of any faith can be a Kabbalist because it is a philosophical system. I personally know Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Mormon, and Gnostic Kabbalists. Kabbalists claim their source goes back to Father Adam, and blindness corrupted the transmissions of the Kabbalah, but through the process of Tikkun, that which was lost can be restored again. Kabbalah attempts to answer the four basic questions of life. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? Kabbalists attempt to open up themselves to their inner spiritual world through a heightened sense inside themselves, to live their lives with real intent, arriving at the point that the 13th century Kabbalist Abraham Abulafra describes, quote, "Now we are no longer separated from our source, and behold, we are the source, and the source is us. We are so intimately united with it, we cannot by any means be separate from it, for we are it," close quote. The three levels of the Kabbalah of joining and restoring ourselves with the source that Smith and Abulafli refer to are theosophical, theurgic, and ecstatic. On the theosophic level, we have an understanding of the 10 traits of godliness that are manifest in the 10 respective sephirot in the Kabbalist's tree of life. These 10 traits are like vessels of light, containers to store the particles of light that emulate from the presence of God. The vessel represents our spiritual divine self, not the outward body or shells which it is imprisoned. The process of filling the vessels with light is called Ein Sof. Initially, in our mortality, all vessels are filled with darkness. The purpose of life is to expel the inherent darkness within the vessels and replace it with the fullness of light. We fill the vessels with light and truth until such a time when the body is completely full of light and then reaches equilibrium with God as the source of all light. Striking comparisons to Doctrine and Covenants, Section 50, Section 88, and Section 93. In other words, on the theosophic level, we are trying to be like God. The next level Smith describes is the theurgic, which corresponds to doing. In Judaic traditions, it is applying the philosophy to the 613 codes and laws of the law of Moses. In Christian traditions, it would be applying to Jesus' simplified laws of love, loving your fellow man as yourself. Regardless of our traditions, when we are true to the theurgic, we can finally have what we sought, the reuniting to that mystical source from the power from which we came, that third level, the ecstatic. The study and application of all four steps of Torah, Talmud, Midrash, and Zohar have that singular purpose. None are an end in themselves. All exist as tools to bring to pass that immortality and eternal life of man to reach this ecstatic level. Man has potential to reach and the being, doing, having level equilibrium with God. He and she can become like God. He does like God and is joint heir to all that God has. Why is Smith's paper useful and important to the LDS community? Foremost, his comments that Mormon scholars have misinterpreted the Zohar. But I glean many other gems of information. Just for example, one, I found Smith's interpretation of Gilgul Muhudas, which I cannot pronounce like he does, Muhudas, particularly insightful in reference to the transmigration of spirits. I clearly was able to visualize the tunnels and the caves that lead to this land of Israel instead of the cloudy interpretations I had of Gilgul before reading from Orson Pratt and Alexander Nybar. Seeing Smith more accurate and literal interpretation will guide me in understanding Orson Pratt's writings in the matter in the future. In the LDS Church, the lens through which its members view everything is the first question that Joseph Smith asked God, "Which church should I join?" His question was not, "God, what is your will for me?" It was not, "God, what must I be and do to become more like you?" At the very outset of Smith's religious journey, he had a zeal for an institution as the solution for the problem. He sought a church to join. As a result of this perspective, the church as an institution became an area of focus on his journey, and everyone who follows the journey of Mormonism follows the same path. Due to excessive zeal in pursuit of creating the true church, quote, as an institution that is more true than any other church, sacrifices to scholarship have been made in the name of the worthwhile cause. We defend actions in the name of zeal towards a church instead of based on knowledge. If we are too dependent on an institutional church as the only true church or a true means to become like God, then we rely on the institution as our compass, when in reality, all of the sacred texts of all of the world's great religions, including Judaic and Mormonism discussed here, teach to connect at the deepest level with the source itself. John Taylor is quoted in Smith's paper stating, "The wise men and sages held their intelligence as a secret mystery who generally conveyed it in unknown characters and symbols and hieroglyphics, all the more or less Kabbalistic." But he failed to finish the quote. Taylor finishes that they might have more power over the people. In other words, the mystery of the Kabbalah were kept by the religious leaders so that they would maintain their jobs in the institutions of which they were part. Martin Luther proposed a system that the power of understanding God's words was in the power of everyone. One did not need to go to a priest to have an audience with God, which thought dominated the Reformation, the Radical Reformation, and the Restoration movement ever since. I'm going to just back up and just, as I wrote this morning, 4 o'clock this morning, on my way here. I got the paper yesterday.
You've got about 6 minutes left.
6 minutes, I got, yeah, that's fine, just real quick. Despite the fact that McConkie misquoted the Zohar, I was reading in his last talk that he gave in the General Conference, I think it was April 85, and I went through and I found the 10 traits of the Sephirot, all listed in that final last monumental talk that he gave. In terms of the kingdom, one of the Sephirot, Jesus taught his disciples the doctrines of the kingdom, that quote is in there. Victory, that phrase, when the victory had been won, he said, it is finished, referring to Christ. Glory, he refers to reign with him in his everlasting glory. Mercy, he talks about, he made mercy available to those who believe in his holy name. Justice, his suffering satisfied the demands of justice, is quoted in there. Wisdom, that Sephirot, cast aside the wisdom of the wise and the philosophies of men and hearken unto the Spirit. Understanding, join with me in gaining a sure knowledge and understanding of the atonement. Crown, rising from death on the third day, crowned the atonement. So regardless if it was misquoting or not, it appears that there perhaps could have been some influence of the Kabbalah and the Tree of Life woven into his thinking. In the last 8 years, I've examined the Kabbalistic writings of Zohar from such authors as Jerusalem Sholem, Daniel Matt, David Cooper, and LDS author Joe Sampson. It has assisted me in defining why it can be important to us as Jews, Mormons, and scholars. One of the most delightful authors in the Kabbalah writings is Pico della Mirandola, arguably the most learned Christian Kabbalist in the Renaissance. He was the instructor of such great thinkers as the great martyr Savonarola and Jacob Reuchlin. On the personal side, he also was a teacher of my 12th great-grandfather, Francis DiMarcia from Italy. As Francis Yates says, if there is such a thing as the manifesto of the Renaissance, Mirandola's Oration on the Dignity of Man is it. No other work more forcefully, eloquently, or thoroughly remaps the human landscape to center all attention on human capacity and the human perspective. I'd like to quote just from a paragraph from it. I quote, imagine the great generosity of God, the happiness of man. To man it is allowed to be whatever he chooses to be. As soon as an animal is born, it brings out all its mother's womb that it will ever possess. Spiritual beings from the beginning become what they are to be for all eternity. Man, when he entered life, the Father gave seeds of every kind and to every life possible. Whatever seeds each man sows and cultivates will grow in him and bear the proper fruit. I'll skip over the remainder in the interest of time. But I believe this passage captures the essence of what the Zohar and the Kabbalist texts are about. However, this was such a radical concept to an institutional church which dominated Europe spiritually and temporally, it was a threat to that institution. Preachers and priests aren't as important when their people are empowered for their own salvation. Mirandola's zeal and conviction certainly comes through. I'm going to skip this little part too here to get to where I want to go. As I read Smith's paper, I am more reminded and aware of the struggle between the institutional church and our zeal to protect its image through sloppy scholarship can run against the divine seeds and sparks within us. Our zeal to maintain rightness of our Orthodox institution, whether it be Jewish, Mormon, Catholic, Muslim, or whatever, can lead to a blindness from the truth. Instead of more inclusion in the community, this zeal leads to more separation. As Scott Peck states, that which brings us together in one community is also that which separates us from other. What is really needed for Zionistic conditions to flourish is for people to find a single-minded community, that one mind and one heart that perhaps every religion can draw us to connect to our God as a source of all truth and not merely to its institutions. Conclusion. primary underlying message of the Zohar is to obtain a greater self-awareness of the process to become like God. The Zohar itself states, quote, "You beings on earth who are in deep slumber, awaken. Who among you has labored to turn darkness into light and bitterness into sweetness? Stop sleeping. Wake up." This counsel is to Jew, Christian, Muslim, and Mormon alike. This becomes a supreme goal. Perhaps all religions can agree on a single community. It appears that even if our four of our leading LDS scholars may have been sleeping when they were discussing the Zohar in their Zia, they inadvertently misinterpreted it. The impact of that zealous approach becomes those readers form even tighter, inclusive, institutionalized communities. Two, the truths of other communities are glossed over, unappreciated, undervalued. And three, walls emerge separating these religious communities. The Zohar, the Kabbalah, are bridges to allow us to enjoy the marvelous fruit of the tree of life, marvelous and white, desirable above all other fruit. 1 Nephi chapter 8.
According to my timepiece, we have 30 seconds for questions. However,
did you plan that well or what?
No. That's right. They're trying to get out of it any scholarly inquiry into their ideas, right? But we're not here to let them get off that easy. We have 15 minutes before other people come in. Let's do at least 5 minutes of questions, please.
I'd like to
please speak from the microphone.
Bruce
go ahead.
Bruce.
ABD Smith or whatever. My question is two questions really. One is how do you like John Gill's treatment of the Zohar? Is he fairer or less fair than some of the other Christian interpreters? Secondly, one of the things that interests me is the spread of Gnostic systems up through the Middle Ages. Sometimes I've heard the Kabbalah described as sort of a Jewish overlay of the old Gnostic systems. What do you think about those two things?
What was the first part? Just said it.
John Gill.
That's all I needed to
do. There are a couple issues regarding early meaning Renaissance, Reformation, Christian usages of Zohar. Oddly enough, the people who will actually get the Zohar more correct are the anti-Semitic writers in Germany on Kabbalah, because they don't have a need to see Kabbalah as a particular source for them, per se. Whereas when you get to somebody like John Gill, who you can get his entire biblical commentary on a CD-ROM for $20. That's how I know how many he has. What you will find is because of the need to find Jewish support for Christian interpretations, it's going to be a more colored kind of thing. So that's one. Gnosticism. Well, we have a lot of problems with that phrase. One, what does the word Gnosticism mean? In scholarly discourse, most academics are slowly but surely giving up on using the word Gnostic because we can't pin it down. It's like we know it when we see it, but we can't define it, and we academics, we got to be able to define something somehow, so we're just back away from that. If Gnosticism means just via what the word means in Greek, gnosis, knowledge, if that's what it means, this secret knowledge that is somehow salvific, probably not. If it refers to dualism, clearly not, because Kabbalah is not a dualistic system. It's a monistic system. Unlike, for example, let's compare Mormonism to Kabbalah for one sec. Mormonism posits itself as a pluralistic system. We as intelligences have existed forever. We are the same species as God, but we are individuals. Kabbalah posits a monistic system. It is basically pantheistic. And so consequently, this will get difficult when I teach it as an undergrad class. It makes the undergrads just freak out. For example, Paul in the New Testament talks about in Christianity there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek. That is a monistic system. Everything's blended into one. It's all the same thing. Kabbalah does one tweak to that, though. It is a monistic system that only has one of the two binary opposites. In other words, what this means is there is only good, there is only Israel, there is only right, that the opposites of that, which are bad, Gentile, left, are just the reverse of what the other is. There is no existence of evil in Judaism. Evil is just the lack of good. Christianity has a Satan. In Judaism, we don't have a Satan the way Christians have. So consequently, if you're talking about that form of Gnosticism, where in a sense it is dualistic in this realm, but monistic in that realm, there may be, because there are a group of scholars, I agree with them. Why? Probably because I'm Jewish, that Gnosticism started in Judaism. Most scholars do not hold that view. Most scholars say that Gnosticism started as a Christian offshoot. As to its influence on Kabbalah, given the Cathars and stuff in southern France, Gaux-Provence, and all the heretics, maybe, maybe not. It's unclear right now.
All right. I see no other questions. I think we'll call it a wrap. Thank you very much, Bruce and Bruce.
No, Albany.
There you go.
But I appreciate getting copies of both of you.
Sure. I'll email it to you. Yep.
So is there a chance to be here next year?
Maybe, yeah.
One of the things I really wanted to do, and this sounds kind of glib, but it has some sincerity. I'd love to do a panel on guilt, where there's classic guilt that make America greater, Jewish guilt and Catholic guilt. I'd like to have someone representing the Jewish faith community, one representing the Catholic community, one representing the Mormon community, talk about different conceptions of guilt.
Sure. Because I always come back to Colorado this time, so getting over something.
No, that'd be great. So I'll have your contact info when you send things, and I appreciate that.
Sure.
I appreciate your remarks.